Welcome to Worlds Apart. The end of colonialism is usually celebrated as one of the few silver linings of the Second World War, which made the explicit economic and political subjugation of one people by another not only logistically challenging, but also morally reprehensible. And yet, if we look at the country's ability to pursue their own paths and make decisions truly in the interests of their people, have we authentically departed from the pith helmet? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Shahida Vizarat, professor at the Institute of Business Management in Karachi, Pakistan. Professor, it's great to talk to you and great to welcome you in Moscow because we don't get too many foreign visitors these
days. Thank you.
Now, you come from Pakistan, which recently went through the change of leadership that some, including former prime minister, attributed to your country's intention to win itself off Western influence. Is that something that you buy, the explanation that you buy? And do you think that's still the intention of Pakistan, both its leadership, its current leadership, and the people?
Well, I think that this is what the former prime minister has been saying. But I also feel that he had these 3.5 years when he was the prime minister. I think he should have used that time very effectively to forge a closer relationship with the Russian Federation and with the People's Republic of China and other regional countries. But unfortunately, I was not very happy with the pace of progress that was going on with the relationship between these countries. I, for myself, I've been, you know, for the last almost 30 years, I have been, trying to suggest that Pakistan belongs to the region and that Pakistan should develop greater economic and strategic relationships with the Russian Federation, with the People's Republic of China and Afghanistan and Iran and all these, you know, Turkey. So I think that I like the former prime minister's narrative, but I'm not sure whether he actually used it when he was losing power, so he used it politically. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Now, many people have argued that Pakistan and others need to sort of free themselves from Western guardianship. But I think you in your writing went far more radical. You've been actually suggesting that many countries in Asia, in the Middle East, in Africa are still under the yoke of colonialism, which is a pretty strong statement and very hard statement for any patriotically minded person to accept. Aren't you being too harsh?
No, I think that that's a fact, at least in Pakistan and many other countries as well. For example, in Pakistan, we are an independent country, supposedly. But in spite of that, a lot of our important positions are, appointed by both USA and UK. Prime Minister and other ministers, all the economic managers come from the international financial institutions. And then if you look at our policies, whether it is economic policies or whether it is strategic policies or political, they're also made in the US and UK. Mm-hmm. So I personally feel that we are independent. We like to celebrate independence and people like to think that they're independent. But I personally feel that that we are independent only, in name. You know, for example, the colonial transfers that used to take place when Pakistan and all these other countries were in the colonial mode, I feel that they're still continuing in some form. Sometimes they are given more respectable names. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that you mentioned that because in one of the interviews, you said, for example, that Pakistan got nothing for the American use of infrastructure during the so-called war on terror, despite the fact that you not only lost in terms of resources, but also, you know, tens of thousands of lives of your people. And that's a fascinating fact that you have sacrificed and provided so much without... What actually did you get in return?
Actually, there was this coalition support fund, and that the United States used to pay us peanuts for the use of our infrastructure. And all our infrastructure got, destroyed because of the use of, those vehicles and things. And for a few days, for 11 days, when Pakistan refused to give its facilities because of the incident at Salalah, at that time, some small Central Asian republic made billions of dollars.
I heard you say in another interview that the Pakistani political forces, regardless of their ideology, may sound very patriotic when they are in opposition, but once they come to power, they tend to become quite compliant with foreign interests. And I wonder if it's in a way logical, because if we look around, there are very, very few countries, if any, that can afford to be fully insulated from foreign influences.
If you look at Pakistani governments, particularly, if you look at the last government, the Prime Minister had made so many commitments and he had said so many things. But I think after he came to power, he had said that he will kill himself rather than go to the IMF. And then when he came to power, he went to the IMF. And then there was this...
Did he have a choice? Do you think he realistically had a choice in his economic policies to pursue some other route?
A lot of people used to say that there is no alternative and that that only alternative is to go to the IMF. And I, being an economist, every time there was a change in government, I used to write an article and send it to the potential prime minister, etc. And I used to tell them that this is the alternative and that they should not go to the IMF. But every time, even all the governments that came to power, they used to be criticizing the sitting government that went to the IMF. Mm-hmm. But then, the moment they came to power, they would themselves go to the IMF. Mm-hmm. So I gave them an alternative. And I publicized my alternative, and I gave seminars on the alternative, and I gave conferences. And I said that, look, this is the alternative. And this is my alternative, is a far superior alternative to the IMF.
Well, let me ask you specifically about the issue of the central bank autonomy, because I know that you criticized Imran Khan very vocally for that. On the surface, it seems that giving the autonomy to central bank is a way to secure it from corrupt local interests, but you, in fact, argued that it is a way of delivering the country directly to the IMF. Do you believe there is any middle path that would allow the country to go its way, protect itself from vested interests both inside and outside?
Actually, I feel that if the state bank was actually being made autonomous, then all the institutions in the state bank, the committees and the boards, should have been strengthened. But that did not happen. Actually, the executive board was dismantled, and a very important executive committee was dismantled, and all the powers were transferred to one person, to the governor. Now, if you are really making the state bank autonomous, then you should be strengthening its institutions and its committees and boards. Mm-hmm. But that did not happen. All the powers were transferred to one person, governor, who was an IMF employee. Mm.
So strengthening, you mean diversifying the influence, introducing many stakeholders who would influence the policy rather than making it so centralized.
Yes, not making it so centralized, because you see, everything depends on one person. And for example, earlier there was this board, and the board had its own, a lot of members, and there was the quorum. But what they did was that the quorum consisted only of the governor and one deputy governor. Mm-hmm. So almost two or three people constituted the quorum. Mm-hmm. So with the result that if they were given any orders from Washington, they would comply with those orders because there were just three people mm-hmm. who met the quorum.
I heard you say that the premature departure of Imran Khan from office was due not so much to the differences in policy between Pakistan and the United States, but to the personal relationship between Imran Khan and Joe Biden, that they had some sort of a falling out. If that was indeed the case, isn't that even worse than colonialism? Because that seems that, the entire fate of 220 million people is dependent on the personal relationship between two men.
Actually, what happened was, prior to Joe Biden coming to power, Trump had a very close relationship with Imran Khan and with Boris Johnson and with Moody. Mm-hmm. they had formed some sort of a, you know, triangle, and they were very close. Even when the presidential elections were taking place, both Imran Khan and Narendra Modi had gone to the U.S. to muster support for...
Which is, on the surface, not a bad thing. I mean, we are so used to Pakistan and India arguing that it made for a good video, at least.
Yeah, but you see, the problem is that when Joe Biden became the president, I think he got offended. Mm-hmm. He thought that they were totally with Trump. Mm-hmm. And I think for some reason, because India is a big country, Joe Biden couldn't afford to continue with this antagonism towards Modi. But I think he started ignoring Pakistani Prime Minister, and he was doing all the business with General Bajwa. So I think that irritated Imran Khan. Now, I feel that I would have been totally supporting Imran Khan if he had picked up this. The narrative is very good. I am all out for the narrative, because if he had taken up this sort of fight on account of state bank autonomy or IMF succumbing so much to the IMF or on Kashmir, or on Afghanistan, then I would have been very supportive of Imran Khan. But I feel that when it came to Pakistani national issues, Imran Khan gave in completely, and so did General Bajwa. Mm-hmm. Both of them did. But I think Pakistan and other developing countries need to get out of this colonial mode. And I think what is worrying to me is, I've recently written an article in which I've said that actually what's happening is that the Western countries, especially the United States and UK, they're taking the developing world back to the colonial order, mm-hmm. to the 1945 order. And I think this started happening immediately after 9/11, and that is why a lot of people feel that 9/11 was actually a staged thing. And I think that is why, you know, the first attack was on Afghanistan. And after that attack, for 20 years, Afghan resources and all the, you know, lithium and uranium was taken out of Afghanistan. And then Iraq was attacked for the second time in 2003. And also, I think, difficulties being faced by Sri Lanka and Pakistan and Turkey. So it looks like all these countries are standing in a queue. Mm-hmm. And they're being hit one by one. And if you look at what's happening is that the established order is being dismantled and their resources are being taken out. And they're, for example, I've seen pictures of Iraqi, you know, gold reserves being taken out by U.S. and U.K. nationals.
Mm-hmm. Well, Professor Visarat, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Shahida Visarat, professor at the Institute of Business Management in Karachi, Pakistan. Professor Visarat, just before the break, we were talking about various developing countries suffering through war, through sometimes economic aggression, nowadays through many sanctions because, you know, that fuel and food prices are rising because of the crisis in Ukraine. And many of the countries that have already very little resources have to pay a lot. Now, I mentioned in the beginning of our program that the Second World War formally, at least, led to the end of colonialism. And I hear many experts here in Russia suggest that we are now in a sort of a third world war, a hybrid war, but a war nonetheless. Do you think that war may change to any significant change in the way things are, both economically and geopolitically in the world?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, in many countries, like you said, because of the war in Ukraine, there are lots of problems for many countries, not just developing countries, but for even such a big country like the Russian Federation and also other countries. The costs are spiraling. And so you see what was going to happen is that I think the strategy is different for different countries. Now, some countries are going to be facing economic meltdowns, and that is going to result in dismantling their established order. And I think some countries might actually be facing actual war. So I think that both, you know, for example, war, actual war, and economic meltdown leading to civil strife and economic turmoil, leading to, you know, instability in the country, leading to finally collapse of the system. I think both are going to be used to break down established order in developing countries. Mm-hmm. And then obviously, which means that these countries will then will not be able to protect themselves. So I think that their established order, and I mean other countries will come over, powerful countries will come over and take their resources.
Now, I think there is one thing in common when it comes to security between Russia and Pakistan is that we both were sort of seduced by security promises. You were given certain promises when it comes to the war on terror. We were given certain promises when it comes to indivisible security in Europe. I think both of our countries are more insecure as a result of believing in those promises, but Russia came to a point where it is now waging a military operation against its neighbor. As honest as you can afford yourself to be, how do you look at it? Do you think it was inevitable? Do you think Russia realistically had perhaps a more humane, a better, a more efficient option to deal with its concerns?
I think it's very unfortunate. Loss of life in Ukraine and Russia is very unfortunate because this, you know, human lives. So, I mean, I would feel sympathetic to both to the loss of Russian lives as well as Ukrainian lives. I don't know much about it because I've been concentrating. There's so many problems in Pakistan. So normally you get bogged down in your own problems. But actually, I would hope that, you know, that the Ukrainian conflict would be resolved peacefully and that both the parties will try to resolve the problems. Like, I would also hope that Pakistan and India would try to resolve the Kashmir problem.
But is that, do you think that's in line with what we have discussed previously, the sort of post or neo-colonial aspirations of certain Western powers? Because I know that many academics, let's say in India or even in Pakistan, believe that one of the reasons this conflict has been going on for so long is because it's in the interest of the UK and the
Absolutely.
US to see those two neighbors fighting. And there are many people here in Russia, including President Putin, who said the other day that he believes that all those supplies of Western arms to Ukraine are motivated by one goal only, to prolong the conflict and to have the Russians and the Ukrainians continue to fight. Do you think that's all part of the strategy or of the same strategy, or am I stretching it too far?
I think it could very well be, because you see, the fight, you know, the conflict, I mean, the war in Ukraine, I think it's after a long time that there's been a conflict in Europe. And I think that from that point of view, there's a big qualitative change, because after the Second World War, what the Western countries are said to have decided was no more war, because they were so devastated by the horrors of war that they said no more war. But I think what the Western world actually said was no more war in the Western world. Mm-hmm. Because after the Second World War, all the wars were exported to the Eastern countries or to the developing countries. Now, if you look at the present day situation, you find that there is total conflict, and it looks like that all the developing countries have been turned into a war theater. Mm-hmm. But from that point of view, this is a very big qualitative change that there is a war in Europe. Mm-hmm. And I've read interviews of people, Western countries, European and American. I mean, they say that the things they say is quite offensive. They say that, you know, people like us are getting killed. I mean, they don't realize that the wars that have been taking place in the developing countries, there are human beings getting killed there as well. But it looks like...
Millions, in fact, of them.
Yes, but it looks like they were just, you know, like rats and mice, that they were getting killed and they were being bombed. Something like this happens in Europe, then it's a very serious thing. So that, I think, I find very offensive.
Can I also ask you a couple of questions on China? Because I know you've written a book on China, specifically on what lessons can Pakistan and perhaps some other countries draw from China's economic success. Both Russia and Pakistan have strong ties with this nation. And I guess one can argue that we are essentially trading one dependency, the dependency on the West, for another dependency, in this case, dependency on China. How is being partners with China differs from being partners with the United States in your view?
Good question. I think, you see, if you look at Pakistan for the last 75 years, Pakistan had been trying very hard to develop the country using help from the international financial institutions. We first got some project-based lending for our infrastructure, for our, dams, Darbela Dam and Mangla Dam. And I think at the same time, because the Soviet Union was there and the Americans were there, I think this was the best time for developing countries to develop because the environment was not hostile for developing.
And you had the best of both worlds. You can
exactly
use both of them.
But what happened was that... especially when the Asian tigers became industrialized and the late coming Asian tigers became industrialized, then there was this feeling in the West that the industrialization of the developing world was responsible for the deindustrialization of the advanced Western countries because a lot of industries were closing down in England and other Western countries. So what happened was that they changed even the rules for the international financial institutions. Instead of giving project-based lending, they reverted to policy-based lending. And the point that I'm trying to make is that with policy-based lending, take the example of Pakistan, I mean, we have devastated our economies through trying to get money for budgetary support. And when you go to the IMF, their policies are very contractionary. You end up reducing your output growth, your employment growth. You increase your rate of inflation. You increase the skewness in the distribution of income. And you increase poverty. And then you also invite a social crisis because when poverty level is increasing so much, crimes increase.
Do you think that's intentional or is it just the lack of foresight? I mean, the policies, because the way you are describing it, it gives you a lot of trouble for very little benefit. Do you think that was designed or do you think it's just, the economic dogma that the West wants to...
Yeah. I was talking about the West and I said that there was this feeling that there was in the industrialization and the developing countries was responsible for the deindustrialization and the advanced countries, Western countries. So that is why they went around changing the rules. And then they had the counter-revolution. The counter-revolution... was actually a reaction to the Keynesian revolution. And the counter-revolution actually, resulted in the implementation of neoliberal policies. And those same policies were adopted by the international financial institutions when they were giving aid to developing countries.
But do you think those policies, are they ultimately serving the developing countries or they are designed with the developed world in mind?
They were designed with a view to deindustrializing developing countries. For example, if you look at Pakistan, a lot of the industries have closed down and several lakh people have been rendered unemployed. So this couldn't have been, it's not that their economics is so poor that they have those PhDs in economics sitting there and bringing in policies which would lead to such massive unemployment, massive reduction in output growth. So obviously, they have formulated the policies in such a way that these developing countries are faced with serious problems when they turn to the IMF. Mm-hmm. So this was in context mm-hmm. with China. Yeah. I'm trying to connect it to China. We had this problem for the last 75 years that we did not get development, although we went to the IMF so many times and our governments went and ended up destroying our economy. And then we had this, the Chinese came with this One Belt, One Road project. And part of the, in Pakistan, the part of the project is CPEC. Now, when we had the CPEC, there was a lot of antagonism from India, from US and UK and other Western countries also. So it looks like that they do want to let us develop through going to the IMF, but they are equally adamant not to let us develop through getting, CPEC. So, because the countries were, US and UK were openly, denouncing CPEC. I feel that this is the first time that Pakistan was able to get some development. Having said that, I also feel that if we have governments that have some strength, have the knowledge, are honest, then they can negotiate better with the Chinese. Because in China, there is zero tolerance for corruption at the highest level. So Chinese governments are very honest when they're dealing with other countries. And if other countries' governments are equally honest, then they can both, what Ajit Singh called technological rents, the division of technological rents between the host country and the investing country. So I think it all depends how much you are able to get out of any foreign investor depends on how well you are able to negotiate with them.
So can I very quickly ask you one question about Chinese leadership? Because in your book, you pay a lot of attention to Confucian qualities, and you say that the Chinese never look for celebrities with charisma. Instead, their philosophy enjoins upon them to look for substance. And it seems like such an obvious and necessary orientation for any country in this day and age. But why do you think it hasn't succeeded anywhere beyond China? Because at the end of the day, we are all paying a lot of attention to, charisma and political statements, not so much to the actual facts on the ground.
Can I just make one correction?
Yeah.
That I haven't written this book. This book was written by Ambassador mm-hmm. Hassan Javed, mm-hmm. and I wrote a review of that book. Okay? I've written other books, mm-hmm. but this book is written by a former ambassador.
But you still agree with this assessment?
I agree with this, absolutely, because I feel that, there is this thing about Chinese wisdom. I think that has something to do with it. Like we all always think the Chinese are very wise people. I think Chinese are using their wisdom for the benefit of their country. And for example, other countries where voters go and vote, and they just, look at a personality and they feel that the personality is good looking, dashing, and then there's a lot of falling. But I think Chinese look for substance. They look for, they discuss the Confucius qualities for leadership. And I think that's really the way to go about it, because then you know that the person is honest, the person has the knowledge, the person is, he'll make a good leader, he has leadership qualities. So I totally believe that in the, these qualities. Mm-hmm.
Well, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for your wisdom today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.